Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. More than 50 million people in this country don't know where their next meal is coming from. And of those 50 million, 16.7 million are children. This hour, we talk about hunger in America. Christy Jacobson is joining us. Christy is an award-winning director and producer of nonfiction films and television, and her latest documentary is A Place at the Table, and it looks at all of the issues that are associated with what has been called now food insecurity in the United States. It focuses movingly on several people who are experiencing this dilemma of where am I going to get my next meal for myself and for my children. And here's one of the people who is featured in the film.
The assistance programs in the United States are very hard to qualify for. It's like either you're starving or you don't get any help. But what defines starving? Like, if you don't eat for a day, are you starving? In their eyes, no. But in your eyes and the way you feel, of course.
That's Barbie, a single mother in Philadelphia, one of the people who is featured in the film A Place at the Table. Perhaps you heard Joy Cardine's discussion earlier today. The author of the book A Place at the Table was her guest, and our guest is the documentarian, the director and producer of A Place at the Table, Christy Jacobson. Christy, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. You see this film and you say, oh my gosh, I thought we had taken care of this problem. And when you look, as you do at one point in the film, of the number of people who don't know where their next meal is coming from year by year, you dramatically show that the number is going up.
Yeah. It is shocking. And, you know, as a filmmaker in the process of making the film, there were so many moments, whether it was facts that we discovered through research or people whom we met and whose experiences we got to know and understand, that really shocked us, you know, that here in the nation's wealthiest country, we have this many people struggling to put food on the table. And more important, that struggle, that experience of hunger and food insecurity has devastating consequences on individuals, on families, on communities, but also on our nation.
Right. And also, as you look at in the film, very importantly, is this link between food insecurity and our health and our obesity epidemic.
Yes. I think that, you know, most people in America are aware that we have an obesity problem. Certainly the media is not shy about covering that story. But what people don't often realize is that, you know, in fact, most areas where obesity is the highest, it's not about people making bad choices. It's about our food system. It's about people who don't even have access to healthy foods that aren't processed. And when they do have that access, well, then they can't afford those foods. And I think that's a piece of our, you know, this national health crisis that is missing from the conversation.
You are doing a book. You're doing this documentary. I have seen you interviewed on national television shows. You think about and you make reference to a CBS documentary that focused attention on hunger and it resulted in policy change. Are you hopeful that that will happen as a result of all of your efforts?
I am hopeful that that will happen. And that film, that 1968 documentary, had such dramatic impact on, first and foremost, you know, the awareness of you know, the American people who didn't know that this was happening right here in their own backyard. But when they did understand that it was happening, they acted. They picked up the phone, and as we've been told by many, the phone lines were literally jammed in D.C. And there were immediate results. Just earlier this week, we received an email from one of the physicians who was involved in the studies that took place in 1968 that were featured in that documentary. And he wrote to us and he said, then as now, the problem was denial and obstruction in Congress. And then people really stood up and said, we're not going to have this anymore. This is not okay. And so we're hopeful that today this film and the book and the campaign will have a similar outcome, which will give people not just the information and the emotional push, but also the tools in terms of our social action campaign to put that pressure on our Congress people to make this a priority.
There are so many issues involved with hunger in America, and let us start with the issue of agricultural subsidies. This is a huge issue. We just don't subsidize healthy foods, do we?
We do not. And as we show in the film, you know, through one of our animated graphics, you know, only 1% of all the federal farm subsidy monies go to fruits and vegetables. It's, you know, if you look at sort of the national guidelines, it used to be the pyramid and now it's a plate. If we were to create a plate that represented what we subsidize, there would be, you know, one tiny pea, or actually probably more likely a kernel of corn, on that plate. So we're not putting our money into the kinds of foods that lead to a healthy and productive population.
The thing that was interesting, and please guide me through this, was that the subsidies program was to help small farmers after the Depression, and then we never really changed our policy, so now it's helping really big, big farmers. We don't have a Depression anymore, but we never really examined what we were doing, did we?
Exactly. I think that's true, sadly, of a lot of policies that exist today. The intentions were to help those in need, which at that time were small farmers. But over time, you know, this has become, the subsidy program has become a policy that really benefits the few at the expense of the many. And there are huge agribusiness corporations that are benefiting from these subsidies while small farmers are struggling. And I think, you know, too often that's the case. And again, I think that we need to have our voices heard on this and other policies like that.
The other issue that becomes so painfully aware in the film, and it's most poignantly told in Mississippi, which has the highest rate of food insecurity and of obesity, that people just don't have access. If you're poor, chances are you don't have a car, you don't have money to get out of your neighborhood to go to a place where there is good food, and it's a long trip to get good food because there is no good food in your grocery store.
Yeah. And we experienced that again and again. I mean, the story that we told in Jonestown, Mississippi, of the many people living there who, you know, within a walking distance or a short drive from where they live, you know, it's all processed food. Literally no fruits and vegetables. So you're talking about driving 40, 50 miles to a fully stocked grocery store, and the gas money and all the rest is really makes it cost prohibitive for a lot of people. And what we also found, though, is, you know, while that may sort of in some ways make sense to people, what makes a little less sense is that in urban areas, people also struggle with access to healthy fruits and vegetables. And we saw that with Barbie Izquierdo, who was living in North Philly, who had to take multiple buses, again, to get to a fully stocked grocery store where she actually had the choice. And I think that if we could spend a little less time, and in particular in the media, and I thank you for having us on here, you know, blaming those in these situations, and instead could spend some more time looking at the causes and trying to find solutions, I think we'd be in a much better place.
Right. And it is true. If it's true in the city of Milwaukee. I drive through the city every day to come to work, and there are no grocery stores, big grocery, there are no grocery stores.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real problem when people in this nation do not have access to healthy foods that are affordable. And it's a problem that we don't need to have. It's solvable.
You tell the story so movingly through the eyes and words of people who are hungry. I want to play a little clip from Rosie, who is just this lovely young girl.
Yeah.
God, I just loved her.
She lives in my heart forever.
Oh, I'll bet she does. You're going to keep track of her. She's going places, I think.
She is. You bet.
Yeah. We'll hear a little bit of Rosie, and you can tell us more about her life. But they feature in the film, A Place at the Table, the stories of people who don't know where their next meal is coming from. And here's one of those young people. This is Rosie, who's, I think, about 12 years old. We'll ask Christy to tell more about her, but here's what she says.
My aunt teacher tells me to get focused, and she told me to write focus on my little sticker. And every time I look at it, I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to be focusing. I start yawning, then I zone out, and so I'm just looking at the teacher, and I look at her, and all I think about is food. So I have these little visions in my eyes. Sometimes when I look at her, I vision her as a banana, so she goes like a banana, and everybody in the class is like apples or oranges, and then I'm like, oh, great.
That's a pretty dramatic statement, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. I mean, one of the things about Rosie that makes her so special is she, in that moment, was able to put words to something I think so few people, adults, are able to describe. Therefore making it really, I think, difficult for audience to say, I don't get it. You know, how could you not get it? This girl is wanting to do her best in school, yet is unable to focus. And she's one of 17 million kids in this country who are experiencing that every day. That's really upsetting. And to me, you know, one of the real inspirations for making this film is to tell those stories, because they're not getting out there. And I don't think we should have any excuse as a nation to allow that.
What about so many districts, school districts in the country, Christy, have school breakfast programs, school lunch programs? Are they a significant part in answering the problem?
They are, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because school breakfast in particular, I mean, school meals are federally funded and are an essential part of the solution to this problem, not the only part, but an important piece of it. And recently, in fact, there's been some studies done that show how valuable breakfast in school is. Excuse me, I'm sorry. in terms of increased attendance, increased math scores, and what's happening in a lot of states is that there are federal dollars that aren't being utilized by the states. So this is a really important piece of the puzzle. And Jeff Bridges, who's featured in the film, is a spokesperson for a program called No Kid Hungry, which helps states and people sort of understand what's happening so that their schools can do better.
Mm-hmm.
But also, as you saw in the film and as we captured with our cameras, you know, this program is vastly underfunded and is out of date. And the kinds of foods that we're feeding our kids are, again, not aligned with the kind of foods that we're telling our kids to eat. And, we need to make it a priority.
The other thing that we have relied on since the 1970s, when we had more of a handle on this, as you note in the film, is charity and the number of food banks and the number of churches who have been asked for years now to do these massive feed programs or to have food banks available for people from the community. We really are asking them to solve the problem for us.
Exactly. And I think what we discovered in making this film, that's just too big of an ask. That, you know, we have over time, since the 80s, really shifted responsibility from the government to charitable response and mm-hmm. individuals and faith-based groups sort of stepping up. And you know, food banks were supposed to be emergency food. So this was supposed to be a system that helped people in desperate moments and times of need. But it's become this vast network of, you know, tens of thousands of food banks and food pantries and soup kitchens across the country that are trying to meet the needs of people in their community. But as we saw, for example, in the town of Colborne, they just can't keep up. And many, many food bank directors and organizers, just said to us, the problem is too big. And I think that speaks to, again, that 1968 documentary that squarely and unapologetically said, you know, the government is failing us. If we have a problem, that's great. And we need to call on our government leaders to take action. And I think that we've become conditioned in the past 10, 20 years you know, to when these kinds of stories air on television or the radio, you know, the solution is to have a food drive in your community.
Right.
And that's not the solution to the problem. That is, you know, a piece of dealing with hunger in your community. But I think, engaging people in the, you know, in the political solutions is a very important piece of this that we've learned, in the making of this film.
Christy Jacobson is our guest this hour. She's an award-winning director and producer of nonfiction films and television. The latest documentary is A Place at the Table, and it examines hunger in America, which is very widespread, through the stories of quite a few Americans who don't know where their next meal is coming from. We now call it food insecurity. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're spending time on the Ideas Network this morning, focusing on A Place at the Table. Earlier today on Joy's show, the author of the book, A Place at the Table, talked about food insecurity in this country. In this hour, it is the focus of a documentary film, A Place at the Table. Christy Jacobson, award-winning director and producer, is our guest this hour, and we'll take your phone calls in just one moment.
Are you going to take them off?
Yeah, I got them.
All right. Thank you. Good job on your basketball game.
That's something that's extremely important. The churches and the community groups that do hand out food are doing an incredible service to this country and to the children that are experiencing hunger. But that's just a quick fix. That's for today and tomorrow, maybe for next week. We call it emergency food. It's no longer emergency food. This is called chronic use of a broken system for which people cannot be held accountable.
We go to phone calls now for Christy. Let's start with Alfonso in Madison. Hi, Alfonso.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for a brilliant movie.
I saw it here
in Madison with a group of the faith community. I'm a professor at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. And one of the things that I don't know if you were aware of, but grocery stores in the 60s and 70s consciously left urban areas. You all were speaking to that question of grocery stores in urban areas. And there was, in effect, grocery store redlining in many cities when grocery stores pulled out of inner city of urban neighborhoods for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know if you were aware of that. And then I have another question.
No, I'm not familiar with that term. I mean, I'm aware that there was a conscious move towards not providing you know, grocery stores and these kinds of things. But I didn't know about redlining. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure. If you want, shoot me an email, and I'd be happy to send you the book chapter that I wrote on the subject in a food justice book.
Great.
The other question I have is if you've thought much about the role of, in terms of community regional food systems, if you've thought much about the role of urban food production. I'm not speaking about here small-scale community gardens and things like that, of sort of commercial-scale urban food production. That's something that we're doing research on in several cities around the U.S. And I was just wondering if you thought about that with respect to this.
Alfonso, you're breaking up a little. Kathleen, can you summarize that for me?
He wants to know about larger urban food production in cities. They're doing research on that in several places in the country. Are you aware of
of
that?
Are you referring to things like Will Allen's Growing Power and some of the really innovative things that are happening across the country?
Yeah, Cultivate Kansas City.
Yes.
All over the country.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in any film, you know, you only have so many minutes, lots of decisions have to be made about what ultimately is in the film. But certainly there are really, really important, innovative things happening across the country, in particular around urban gardening. You know, I think that's an important piece, of, again, you know, there's so many different moving parts here. I think, you know, I think that there's some great work being done. And if you want to share something, some things that are happening in Wisconsin, that would be great.
We'll put you on hold and get your email address, because we'd probably be interested, Alfonso, in talking with you as well on a future show. So Rhonda will get your email address and everybody can be in touch with everybody.
Thanks, Alfonso.
Kel in, where are you from? Sugar Camp. Hi, Kel.
Hi. Thank you for your show. It's very informative. I was wondering, I know this may sound very naive, but I would think that being able to get to frozen fruits and vegetables, which aren't as expensive to keep and you don't have the spoilage problem and the transportation costs, would be something more available to people who don't have access to the fresh stuff. I maybe that's naive, but it would seem that it would be easy to set up something small in urban areas where mostly it's frozen things.
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think that's a naive question at all. I think it's really smart. I mean, one of the issues is the refrigeration, and, you know, keeping, you know, paying for that. And also, again, still, even if they're frozen, there's still these fruits and vegetables that aren't subsidized to begin with at the level that, for example, corn and goes into corn, high fructose corn syrup and the processed foods are. So you still are, you know, dealing with the processed, not healthy food being still cheaper than the healthier options. But I think that's a smart thought, and I'm sure that's part of what many people are trying to figure into the solutions.
Thank you very much for the call, Kel. We should also talk a little bit more, Christy, about the people behind these huge numbers, 50 million. It is remarkable how many of these people are working. You feature a rancher who's working as a rancher, and then he's a custodian at the local school at night and still finds that he needs a food program to help feed his family. Most of these people are working.
That's right. I mean, I think that is the... What surprises, I think, a lot of people who see this film is that, you know, when we landed in the town of Colbran, which just feels like, you know, every town in America, it's a, you know, independent, people are trying to work together and help each other. But at the same time, you know, family after family and household after household of one and two working parents who aren't able to put food on the table. And in fact, 80% of recipients of SNAP, which is the federal food stamp program, have at least one working parent in the home. And of that, 75% are working full time. So I think it's really important to take a look at the forces at play that are, you know, at work here. And it's really, really, again, unacceptable when you see, you know, Joel, that wonderful rancher, and Adam, the police chief, who's
yes.
supposed to rely on food pantry. You know, this is across the country happening. Working people who are doing their part and yet still need to rely on either charity or government support when they can get it. But often people who are working, you know, sort of are find themselves in this middle ground of not making enough to put food on the table, but not making little enough to qualify for food programs.
We heard from Barbie earlier, the single mother in Philadelphia, who was availing herself or wanted to of food stamps, but found that her income was such that she couldn't get food stamps. It led me to believe that the eligibility for food stamps might be low in this country. Is it?
Yes. I mean, the eligibility for a family of four, I believe, is $28,000. So if you're making $28,500 for your family of four, you'll not qualify. And I think what Barbie experienced is something that's very, very common, and it's actually so common it has a label. It's called the cliff effect. So what happens is when people are working to get themselves up out of poverty and get off of federal assistance programs, the programs just cut them off hard and then make it more difficult for them to provide for their family and survive on their own. So we're basically penalizing people for trying to get out of poverty with our programs. And I think, again, just to refer back to that 1968 program, that film, what that film did was it showed people, you know, this very upsetting hunger that was happening in the country. But it also forced our government to look at the programs and how ineffective they were and to rethink them and modernize them. And I think that's what we need to do now, because they're not meeting the needs of people who need the programs and who don't want to be on the programs long term. And also part of our campaign is we have something called SNAPAlumni.org, and it's a number of people sharing their stories, that at one point in their life, maybe for a short period of time, maybe for a longer period of time, their family relied on food stamps. And then these people are sharing where they are today. And it's a really great return on the investment, I think, when these programs are effectively run and adequately funded.
Let's go to Alan in Milwaukee. Claire. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Kathleen. One of the benefits of being snowed in is I get to listen to your program.
Thanks. It's spring almost.
I have a piece of important information, and then two quick practical things that I would really love to hear a response on these two points from your guest. I'll just introduce this with a little bit of a prologue, which is just FYI, the sequester does not include congressional salaries and benefits. Now, I was pleased to hear your previous caller mention Will Allen, and I just want to let people know that on Wednesday, April 17th, at UW-Eau Claire Schofield Auditorium, 7:30 in the evening, Will Allen will be speaking about the Good Food Revolution. And for more on that, uwec.edu/activities. Now, my two points are as follows. Obviously, we've got to think about reorganization of our cities. And one thing to consider, I'm not saying we should do it, is a government effort that is a collaboration of federal, state, and local governments with the participation of the residents of various neighborhoods or sectors. There are condemned buildings and land full of rubble that are not being used. And my question is, could these not be condemned, the land cleared, and the residents then, with seeds and instruction, could take up raising their own food? The second point I wish to make has to do with the co-op we have in Eau Claire, Just Local Foods. What they have done, and granted, we're not in the same situation as Milwaukee or Detroit, what they have done is established over the past few years a regional network of local producers that bring product into the store as well as to our wonderful farmers market. Those kinds of organizations are private enterprise and are contributing to the availability of good food that are produced within 50 miles. So those are my points, and I will hang up and gladly listen to the answer.
Thank you, Alan, for your call.
Well, I would thank Alan for all of that. It sounds like there's going to be an exciting talk there with Will Allen, who's really, you know, a revolutionary and someone we admire. I admire a lot. I think that the point about, the reorganization of the cities and the collaboration of, you know, federal, state, local government, and residents is an essential part of the solution, and one of the reasons why we titled the film A Place at the Table and featured Barbie Izquierdo and the Witnesses to Hunger, because it's the residents of that community that need to be a part of the conversation about the solution, and it's the people who are experiencing hunger and food insecurity day in and day out that I believe need to also be a part of the conversation about the solutions. So I'm glad that you brought that up, and it sounds like, if that kind of collaboration can happen, hopefully that land can be used more effectively and efficiently to meet the needs of the members of that community. And as far as what's going on at your local co-op, again, I think that just speaks to the innovation that's happening across the country. And, you know, of course, private enterprise is an important part of that. I think that we need to, again, emphasize that government take a role also. in these solutions. Well, so thanks for all that, Ellen.
Thank you, Ellen, and for your good spirits. Let's talk a little bit more about the government role. We've already said maybe they need to examine agricultural subsidies. Maybe food stamp eligibility is a little low. What else needs to be discussed?
Well, I mean, I believe that broadly this problem of hunger and food insecurity in this nation is costing the nation so much that it needs to be made a priority, and that that's the most important thing that needs to happen. And for that to happen, you know, it requires us to pressure our elected officials, both in Congress and the administration. And by the way, we've provided you all, listeners, you know, the first most important thing is to see the film and talk about it, because I think that sends a very clear message to our elected officials and to leaders in industry that people are not unaware anymore. We can't say we didn't know. We know. We care. This is not okay. Mm-hmm. And we are going to vote, you know, based on how you deal with this issue. So I think, and also you can go to our website, takepart.com/table, to find ways to get involved and to have your voice be heard. So I think that, you know, first and foremost, we need to make it matter. We need to make our politicians listen. From that comes the innovation. You know, for example, in the, again, in the late 1960s, you know, those who saw that film said, this is not okay, we have to do something about it. Senator McGovern, then Senator McGovern, and then Senator Doles, two members of the, you know, different political parties, got together and worked to, as I was saying, you know, modernize the program. So that's when they developed WIC, one of the most effective and efficiently run federal government programs. It's Women, Infants, and Children, and it provides formula and food and nutrition to low-income mothers, pregnant women, and young children. And so that innovation, that program came out of the pressure that the politicians felt to do something. And so first and foremost, we need to put that pressure on the politicians. And then we need to get into the solutions, which, as you mentioned, you know, adequately funding and more rethinking how the food stamp program is working so that we can modernize it to reflect the needs of those, who are utilizing the program. Taking a look at how we subsidize and what we subsidize, and simply, again, making this issue a priority.
Yeah. Let's go to Mike in Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. This is kind of long, but I have a proposal for solving the food problem in America, and my solution would be for our federal government to create a program that financially rewards individuals and families with annual rebate checks whose day-to-day living activities result in the generation of fewer and fewer sustainable amounts of greenhouse gases to our atmosphere. And to get the funding for this program, the federal government would levy a carbon tax on the burning of all fossil fuels such as gasoline, jet fuel, natural gas, diesel fuel, fuel oil, as well as electricity produced by burning coal and natural gas. And then the government would use this money to fund a program that gives annual rebates to all families and individuals who do little or no driving, flying, or consuming large amounts of heating fuel or electricity in their homes. It could simply be measured by measuring annual drivings or using odometers. The FAA would have to keep track of people's flying, probably.
Christy.
Wow. I mean, I am not a policy expert, but a filmmaker, but certainly that sounds like it has some potential. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I know the idea, Mike, that you talked about was touted by some of the participants in the sustainability conference, which took place in Milwaukee, and one of the world's experts on global warming talk to us about that. Mm-hmm. We are speaking this hour with Christy Jacobson. She is an award-winning director and producer of nonfiction films and television, and her latest documentary, A Place at the Table. This is part of a concerted effort. There's a book, there's a documentary. The book is A Place at the Table. You heard Joy interview the author of that earlier today. The documentary is being shown in films, and I'm wondering if it'll be on television. We'll ask Christy about that. So, more phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Earlier, you heard from Rosie, who's a young girl featured in the documentary A Place at the Table. Before we go back to Christy and more phone calls, this is Rosie's teacher, Leslie Nichols, who talks about why some of her students are having difficulties and what they're going through.
Are you going to take them off?
Yeah, I got them.
All right. Thank you. Good job on your basketball game.
That's something that's extremely important. The churches and the community groups that do hand out food are doing an incredible service to this country and to the children that are experiencing hunger. But that's just a quick fix. That's for today and tomorrow, maybe for next week. We call it emergency food. It's no longer emergency food. This is called chronic use of a broken system for which people cannot be held accountable.
An email has come in, Christy. Let's have you respond to this. This is somebody who must work in schools. A difficult time with waste, as children will not eat the fresh fruits and veggies that are provided and often take them home, she does, rather than throw them away. She suggested offering cups of dip so they would eat them, but told it was not an option. When kids grow up eating only processed foods, they won't eat healthier alternatives. Nutritional programs at the source of food shelves to teach them to cook beans and meals from scratch might be helpful. I think this is an omnipresent problem among young people, and it's partially advertising's fault, too. It is difficult if you are eating a lot of chips and sugar and all of that to change your diet to that which is helpful for you.
I think that's, I think it is a challenge. And we certainly know that we are now experiencing, you know, generations of children who are now grown into teenagers or young adults who may have not been exposed to any healthy foods. Barbie Izquierdo in our film, you know, talks about what the impact of that can be, you know, aside from the health and cognitive problems. But I think what we saw, and as we showed in the film, you know, we filmed in Jonestown, Mississippi, a town that is a food desert, a town where many are exposed almost primarily to processed foods and very little fruits and vegetables. But there's this wonderful teacher there, Ms. Odessa Cherry, who found herself diagnosed with diabetes, which is often a diagnosis that is happening with people who are obese or pre-obese, or pre-diabetic, sorry. And she and her school happened to be a school that said, you know what, this is a school in a very, very poor district, not a lot of extra financing around to provide healthier food options, but they did make an effort. And Miss Cherry would bring in, for example, we filmed her bringing in a honeydew melon. She brought it into her classroom of second graders, and she brought the melon whole because she wanted them to see it and feel it, mm-hmm, and know what it would look like in the store. And she did that, and then I was there when she cut the melon and she passed it around, and the kids just literally were sucking it down.
Yeah, they loved it. I know.
They loved it. And she took a moment and she said to these kids, you know, how many of you kids, you know, like what you're eating? And all the hands went up. And then how many of you would rather eat this than a bag of chips? And more than 50% of the hands went up. And so I think that we have to see the potential in our children, and that education and exposure, which means access, is a very important part of the conversation that is often left out. So I think that that email brings, you know, raises a very important point. And then you also mentioned, you know, something that I don't know the statistics about, but I certainly think it's a huge part of the problem, which is these corporations, you know, being able to advertise to kids, and that's a real piece that you know we couldn't get into in the film. But if there's a sequel, we're not going to let that go untouched.
Good. I hope there is a sequel. Yeah. Travis in Rice Lake. Hi, Travis.
Hey. Just wanted to call as one of the success stories of the WIC program. My wife and I had both been working at one time, and then we had to leave that area and went to a new one. I was a school teacher, assistant athletic director, coaching, and we still just could not make enough to feed the family and everything. And so my pride finally gave up, and we gave into the WIC program. And one of the things I liked about it was it's not just money to go buy whatever. It's to buy the essentials of what you actually need. And now both of us are working, we're back up and going and, you know, off the program, and that was great. And I kind of caught the tail end of what Chris was saying there about the food stamp program and trying to have a transition period. And I just kind of had a couple of questions because I'm not really familiar with it, but one of the things I liked about WIC was the fact of you get your milk, you get your bread, your cheeses, your, you know, your meat, the things that you actually need. And I think there's, you know, some misconception because we see people that are buying things with food stamps that they really don't need. And so I'm kind of wondering if that would help if we went in that direction of kind of like the WIC program where here's what you actually need to survive and to, you know, get your nutrition. So this is what you're allowed to get instead of, you know, I'm not really sure how the program works, but I think we've all kind of seen areas where it seems to be abused. So I will hang up. And
thanks, Travis. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Travis. Well, thank you for sharing. And certainly, you know, I think that people like you, you know, coming forward and sharing that there were moments, you know, there was a moment in your life where this program helped you. I think that goes a long way towards countering a lot of the negative portrayals that are out there in the media of people who use WIC or food stamps. To your point about how effective WIC was because it specified what you could buy, I think that's true that WIC is a really effective program and that's probably part of why. I think that, you know, the food stamp program is, you know, working towards, enabling people to live a more nutritious life. It's a nutrition program first and foremost. And, you know, I think that, you know, sure, there are people who abuse any program out there, but I think that the vast majority of people are using food stamps in order to feed their families in the most, you know, healthy way they can. And, again, as we've learned, that's often they don't have access to the healthy fruits and vegetables that one might want them to purchase. So I think we have to sort of circle back to that access issue of making sure that people have access. And one really terrific program that's happening, I know it's in New York and is happening in many places across the country, is there are some places where at a farmer's market your food stamp dollars will be doubled.
Oh, great.
So initiatives like this, I think, are really, really important. But I also think it's important that people have a choice. And by choice, I mean, you know, they have access to things so that they can make healthy choices.
I think it's Marion Nessel who says in the film, what we've witnessed is a 40% rise in fruits and vegetable, the cost thereof, processed foods down 40%.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, it's one of the, I hope, things that the film accomplishes for those who see it. And Travis, I hope that you do get a chance to see the film, is, you know, Barbie Izquierdo in the film explains to us the absolute devastation she felt when she needed to buy that Chef Boyardee and give that to her kids for dinner. But when you don't have anything in your cabinets or your refrigerator and only a few dollars, you're going to buy the food that will fill your child's belly for as many meals as possible. And I think I'm not in a position to judge those kinds of decisions in that moment. And I think that anyone watching this film, I think, will have a greater understanding of the struggle of being hungry and food insecure for moms and dads across the country.
Paul in Sun Prairie, hi.
Hi, my name is Paul. I'm an organic vegetable grower in Sun Prairie. This is a topic that's very close to my heart. I could speak all day about it, but I won't. I'd like to thank you for making the film, and Kathleen, I'd like to thank you for having this on. One of the things, if we look at the political side of all this, we really have to look at our history and go back to the early 1980s, at the beginning of the Reagan Revolution, and how that is being continued today with the extreme right. You're talking about the cliff where people, you know, are penalized, and I see that all the time with people that I know and that I work with. And this and a lot of the problems we're having in poverty in this country are the direct result of the Reagan Revolution. Remember back when that was going on, we were talking about what was going to happen when we reduced welfare, when we reduced money going out to the poor people, the support of them. We were at that time, we were saying these are the things that are going to happen, and lo and behold, they have. So on the political side, when it comes to voting, I think we really need to keep that in mind. I'll hang up and take any comments off the
air. Thanks, Paul. Christy.
Thanks, Paul. Well, I do think that certainly we have seen this that shift of responsibility from the government to charities, an increase in blame on the individuals who are struggling that began in the 80s. And I thank you for bringing that point up. But I also want to point out that, you know, over the past several decades, you know, every president, Republican and Democrat, has played the role because this problem has only gotten worse. It continues to get worse, and I think that we have to hold politicians on both sides of the aisle accountable.
Charles is next in Shorewood. Hi.
Yes, hello. I'm a senior citizen here living in Shorewood, and my question is, why in the world has the government permitted major grocers such as Roundy's, Pick and Save, and the others to increase during this depression period the last 3-4 years? I would go to the store week after week, and things had been increased 40, 50, 60, 70 cents. It's just outrageous, and I am so angry that the government has permitted this. No wonder we have poverty, starvation in this country. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. I can certainly understand your outrage, and encourage you to check out the film and direct your outrage, you know, towards our campaign, which is can be found at takepart.com/table. And thank you so much for sharing. And I hope that we can all be a part of the solution.
We have time for maybe one more phone call. Mary in Kenosha, hi.
Hi, I'm wondering why we aren't taxing or doing something so corporations have to pay for the food they put on the market and tell us that we're better off with this junk food, with corn syrup and corn and wheat. I'm diabetic, and I'm almost not diabetic anymore because I've changed my diet. So I feel through experience I know what's not good for us. And we pay farmers to grow these crops, and I know that cows have to have medicine if they're given silage.
Christy.
Well, I mean, I think you raise a really good point. And, you know, corporations need to behave responsibly. And I actually just read an editorial in the New York Times yesterday that I think you should check out that was written by a former executive at Kraft who left because he felt that there was never going to be change from within. The change needed to come from the outside. And again, I think that speaks to the message that I've been trying to get across, which is that we the people, need to pressure government and these corporations to change their ways.
Thank you for the call. A Place at the Table, the documentary can be seen where, Christy?
Well, this is the great news. A Place at the Table can be seen everywhere. It is available via iTunes and on demand, as well as in theaters across the country. So please, please, please check it out. You can find it on iTunes, on demand, and in theaters. And, you know, watching the film, talking about the film, getting involved in the campaign, reading the book, all of this, because you are all listening, and I know that means that you're interested and care about this. We need to get that conversation and push it on up the hill.
Thanks, Christy, so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for all the really thoughtful call-ins. Thank you,
callers. They're good callers. Christy Jacobson, A Place at the Table is the documentary. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show.